And now, courtesy of the 11L Network, it's LF Midwood.
LF Midwood.
And the Midwood Files. With the LF Midwood Experience. Here on Radio New York International.
Since I came out without any music, I think since I've been back, going on maybe a month and a half, 2 months maybe, not even really sure. Didn't really feel it was super appropriate this week considering the situation in Afghanistan, so I couldn't find anything in my head that worked. Well, welcome to the Midwood Files. My name is LF Midwood, as always. I'm going to get right to it. Tons and tons and tons of stuff here. Let's see. Wow. Tons and tons and tons of stuff. Yeah, that's kind of... I don't know if I want to go with this. There's so much stuff here. It's crazy. It's like Afghanistan. I'm going to go to the... If it'll let me. I'm going to go to the Times... Yeah. Okay, this is New York Times. And this is what we know about the 13 U.S. service members killed in Kabul, in the Kabul attack. And this is Nicholas Bogel Burrows. Department of Defense on Saturday identified the 13 members of the U.S. military who were killed in the attacks on the airport in Kabul, Afghanistan on Thursday as they worked to evacuate people to safety. They hailed from across the country, from California to Wyoming to Tennessee, and had an average age of just over 22. 11 Marines, one was a Navy medic, and another was a member of the Army. Here's what we know about them, and we're going to do this one by one. Marine Corps Staff Sergeant Darren T. Hoover, 31, of Salt Lake City. Staff Sergeant Hoover was a born leader. His father, Darren Hoover, said... who loved the United States and was on his third tour in Afghanistan. He led his men into that and they followed him. But I know in my heart of hearts he was out front, Mr. Hoover said. And they would have followed him through the gates of hell if that's what it took. And ultimately, that's pretty much what he did. Marine Corps Sergeant Johnny Rosario Pichardo, 25, of Lawrence, Mass. Sergeant Rosario should be recognized as the hero she was, her family told the mayor of Lawrence. Her former junior ROTC instructor recalled her as an absolute warrior in high school. And Marine First Lieutenant John Coppola said in a statement that she had been crucial to evacuating thousands of women and children. The Dominican Republic's ambassador to the U.S. said that she was Dominican American, the local woman as well, local girl. Marine Sergeant Nicole L. Gee, 23, of Sacramento, California. In Sergeant Gee's most recent post on Instagram, less than a week ago, she stands next to a long line of people waiting to file onto a military plane at Kabul Airport, escorting evacuees onto the bird, she wrote in another post, in which she is holding a child in Kabul. She wrote, "I love my job." A fellow sergeant wrote on Facebook that Sergeant Gee's car was still in the lot at a Marine Corps base in North Carolina. I drove it around the parking lot every once in a while just to make sure it would be good for her when she came home. Marine Corps Corporal Hunter Lopez, 22, of Indo, California. Corporal Lopez's mother told a reporter in Southern California that her son had recently carried an Afghanistan toddler several miles to safety and asked people to light a candle in his honor. Corporal Lopez's parents both work for the Riverside County Sheriff's Department in California. His father is a captain and his mother is a deputy. Like his parents, who serve in a community, being a Marine to hunter wasn't a job, it was a calling. The Riverside Sheriff's Association wrote in a statement. Marine Corps Corporal Dagan W. Page, 23, of Omaha. Corporal Page grew up in Red Oak, Iowa, and in the area around Omaha, and joined the Marine Corps after high school, his family said in a statement. He had four siblings and was a member of the Boy Scouts, played club hockey, hunted with his father, and had a soft spot in his heart for dogs. They said, to his younger siblings, he was their favorite jungle gym, and to his friends, he was a genuine, happy guy that you could always count on. The family said, adding that he was being mourned by his parents, step-parents, siblings, grandparents, and his girlfriend. Marine Corps Corporal Humberto A. Sanchez, 22, of Wogansport, Indiana. Corporal Sanchez lived in a small city about an hour and a half north of Indianapolis and had graduated from Wogansport High School. The mayor of Wogansport said that Corporal Sanchez still had his entire life ahead of him and that the young man had sacrificed himself by putting himself in harm's way as part of the mission in Kabul. Governor Eric Holcomb of Indiana vowed to honor him in every way possible. Few among us answered the call of duty so dangerous as Corporal Sanchez volunteered to do, he said. Marine Corps Lance Corporal David L. Espinzola, 20, of Rio Bravo, Texas. Lance Corporal Espinzola's mother told a local television station that she had received a call at 2:30 a.m. informing her of her young son's death. I am proud of him because he did what he did. I am proud of him because of what he did. But as a mother, you know, it's hard, she said. Elizabeth Hogan told the station KGNS-TV as she teared up. The station reported that Lance Corporal Espinzola's sister had just turned 13. The corporal was born in Laredo, Texas. His family said that he had been stationed in Jordan for 2 years before being transferred to Kabul about a week ago. He always knew how much his parents loved him, his mother said. Lance Corporal Jared M. Schmitz, 20, of St. Charles, Missouri. Lance Corporal Schmitz lived in the suburb of St. Louis, had been stationed in Jordan on his first deployment before being transferred to Afghanistan for the evacuation mission about 2 weeks ago, his father, Mark Schmitz, told KMOX Radio in St. Louis. It's something that he always wanted to do, and I've never seen a young man train as hard as he did to be the best soldier he could. Mr. Schmitz said that, adding that the family was both devastated and furious. Somebody just came along and took the easy way out and ended everything for him and for us and for those others that were killed, he said. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Rayleigh J. McCollum, 20, of Jackson, Wyoming. Lance Corporal McCollum had a dream of becoming a Marine ever since he was 3 years old, his father, Jim, said in an interview. He, too, was recently transferred from Jordan to Afghanistan, and Mr. McCollum began checking his phone for the little green dot on a message app that showed his son was online and okay. When news came that 13 Americans had died in the attack, he again checked for the dot and sent in a message with no response. In my heart yesterday afternoon, I know, Mr. McCollum said, adding that his son was a beautiful soul. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Dylan R. Marola, 20, of Rancho Cucamonga, California. Lance Corporal Marola was one of the best kids ever, said Cheryl Marola, his mother. He was kind, loving, and would give anything for anybody. She told KCBS-TV. His grandmother told the station that Lance Corporal Marola would frequently say that he wanted to come home to his family, but had been transferred to Afghanistan a week and a half ago. He left a voicemail message with his mother saying that he would not be able to talk to her for a while and that he loved her. Las Osas High School in Southern California, from which he recently graduated, held a moment of silence for him at a football game on Friday. Marine Corps Lance Corporal Kareem M. Nickwee. Yeah, I think it's Nickwee. 20 of Norco, California. Lance Corporal Nickwee was a young martial arts champion whose father told Reuters that he watched television nonstop for updates on the attack until he learned the devastating news from three Marines at his door. He was born at the same time of year it started and ended his life with the end of this war. Wow. Mr. Nickwee said he told the Daily Beast that his son loved Marines, his Marine family, and wanted to make a career of this, and added that he was frustrated that President Biden sent his and others' children in harm's way. Then sent my son over there as a paper pusher and then had the Taliban outside providing security. Wow. Naval Hospitalman Maxton W. Sovic, 22, of Berlin Heights, Ohio. Mr. Sovic grew up playing football in a small northern Ohio community where his death has left a Maxton-sized hole in his loved ones, his sister Marilyn wrote in an Instagram post. He was a Navy medic who had graduated from high school in 2017. Everybody looked to Max in tough situations, said Jim Hall, his high school football coach, who described Mr. Sovic as a deeply loyal friend. He was energetic. He wore his emotions on his sleeve. He was a passionate kid. He didn't hold anything back. Army Staff Sergeant Ryan C. Noss of 23 of Curryton, Tennessee. Staff Sergeant Noss was a motivated young man who loved his country, his grandfather Wayne Noss told WATE-TV in Knoxville, Tennessee. He was a believer, so we will see him again in heaven. He'd been in the military for 5 years, his grandfather said, and his stepmother told the station that he had planned to move to Washington when he returned to the United States. One of his former teachers said he had been quiet but confident in school and that he had written an essay that said his role models were people who stand up against power to help people. He wrote that 9 years ago as a 14-year-old boy, not knowing the man he was going to become. Angela Hoffman, the teacher, told the station. It's all 14. Pretty much at a loss. Wish I'd come up with something to dump out into after that. But like I said, I really couldn't find anything appropriate. My understanding is that there's an alert that there might be, and this is out of the White House, so you have to assume that this is information from the intelligence community, that there probably high probability of another attack at the airport of a similar nature as the one that occurred on Thursday. I'm just going to keep going. This was the Daily Caller. And, all right, my life changed forever, Gold Star. Dad describes waiting for Marines to tell him his son died in Kabul. And this is out of the Daily Caller, and this is Virginia Kruta, who wrote it, Kruta. Gold Star father, Steve Nicoi. Am I saying that right? Nicoi. Described the hours he spent waiting Thursday to hear whether his son was among those killed in the terror attack in Kabul. Nicoi joined Fox host and Daily Caller co-founder Tucker Carlson to discuss his Marine son's, his Marine Lance Corporal Kareem Nicoi's service and sacrifice the day he said his life changed forever. Carlson began the segment with a video of Kareem interacting with a young Afghani girl, saying that they were friends and that he noted that it might be the last video of Kareem in existence. Our hearts break for you. I'm sorry, Carlson said. It's hard to know what to ask you other than to extend our sincere and heartfelt sympathies. Nicoi said that he had been awake for nearly 36 hours and was still in shock, adding that the family had initially been worried about Kareem, but the videos like the one Carlson had shown had begun to put them at ease. The video showed that they were getting the videos we were getting and the pictures that we were getting from him looked somewhat chaotic. We got the video that you just played, and we got the other one that he was really interacting with, you know, the locals, Anukui said, expressing pride and awe in the way his son approached such a difficult situation and a demanding job. It put us at ease where we felt that he's all right. But then he went on to describe the hours leading up to the Marines arriving at his home and telling him that Kareem had been among those killed in the ISIS-K claimed terror attack outside Kabul's airport. So, you know, basically what had happened was, how I found out is I was glued to the TV all day yesterday because, you know, I had woken up and I wasn't feeling well. I felt like something was wrong. My wife felt like there was something wrong. You know, we go downstairs, we realize this happened, you know, and we're like, well, there's some legitimacy, wow, to how we're feeling, Nikoi said. So we're glued to the TV all day. I have my, and I see it's getting 3 wounded, 10 killed, then 12, then 13. You know, so many Afghanis. I'm trying to find out what time this actually took place so that I can reference when he was working and get some sort of insight, Nikoi said. He had hoped that an update when he had hoped to get an update when President Joe Biden spoke to as to whether or not the families had been notified. He was still holding out hope that his son was all right, he was just unable to contact him. Yeah, I don't know why this just went dark on me. Okay, here it is. Previously, I had seen that, you know, the prior administration would normally contact people like first, like the actual president of the United States. So I had some sort of sense that, hey, okay, maybe that would happen. So then that's not happening and things are still transpiring to be a little bit more grave. And I start Googling how long does it take for the military to, you know, inform next of kin. This is the father speaking the whole time. Nikoi said that the internet consensus seemed to be about 8 hours, so he started to prepare for the worst, wanting to intercept anyone who came to the door so that he could be the one to inform his older family members in the event that something had happened to Kareem. He turned on multiple news stations and set up his phone to monitor activity outside his front door. So if anybody were to walk up, I would rush outside and intercept them. I didn't want, if something happens to my son, that these Marines, nothing against them, would tell my family. I felt that that was my responsibility. So I finally realized that they were not going to come at around 3. Then they're going to come between 5 and 10 when everybody is home from work. So then I realized, you know, 5 to 10, if I can make it from 5 to 10, even if I hadn't heard from them, I'll know he's all right. And that does, and he doesn't have a way to contact me because they shut down internet or cell service or whatever, Nick always said. I'm not saying that name correctly, and it's bothering me. The Marines arrived at 7:15, Nikoi said, and when he first saw them, he had hoped that his older son and two friends were returning early from a football game. As soon as I saw them turn the corner and saw it was 3 Marine suits, my life changed forever. I went down there and met them, and I think they did, and I think I did that before they even knocked on the door, Nikoi continued. They were incredible. These young men had so much empathy and were so concerned with me and my family, who luckily my family wasn't there. It was just me at the time. I thank God, you know, I thank Jesus that happened, that I was able to intercept them. And I kept telling them they were like there for like 5 minutes. I was like, let's sign whatever papers we have to sign now. But, you know, to leave the house, because I have to take care of my family. I didn't want someone to come while they're here. They were totally understandable. And then it dawned on me that, yes, maybe I didn't need condolences from them, but I didn't want to. I didn't want to take the opportunity from my other family members, my wife, my son. So I asked them, look, they're at a football game for the high school watching the football game. Can we wait down the street until they come? They want you to come and do the condolence presentation. Those Marines, those boys, sat here for 4 hours. For 4 hours, they sat out there until they came, until my wife came, which is not good. I could not have them come to the house. It was horrible. Like I said, I'd been up for 36 hours. I was in awe, and I was humbled by their performance. Yeah. I have to start getting rid of stuff. Hang on for a sec, or I'm going to get more confused than I normally am. Which is to say, pretty confused. Okay, I did that. I basically did that. I definitely did that. Okay, this was 2 hours ago, and this was the Associated Press. And this speaks to the warning that was issued. This is out of the AP. Kabul, Afghanistan. Taliban forces sealed off Kabul's airport Saturday to most Afghans, hoping for evacuation as the U.S. and its allies were ending the chaotic airlift that will end their troops 2 days, two decades in Afghanistan. Western leaders acknowledged their withdrawal would mean leaving behind some of their citizens and many locals who helped them over the years, and they vowed to try and continue working with the Taliban to allow local allies to leave after President Joe Biden's Tuesday deadline to withdraw from the country. Although most of the allies had finished their evacuation flights, the U.S. planned to keep its round-the-clock flights going until the deadline, saying 113,500 people had been evacuated since August 14th, the day before the Taliban claimed Kabul. Biden warned Saturday that commanders told him that another attack was highly likely in the next 24 to 36 hours, and the U.S. Embassy issued a new security warning early Sunday for all Americans to avoid the airport area entirely. Britain ended its evacuation flight Saturday, though Prime Minister Boris Johnson promised to shift heaven and earth to get more of those at risk from the Taliban to Britain by other means. Britain's ambassador told Britain's ambassador to Afghanistan, Laurie Bristol, told a video from Kabul Airport, said in a video from Kabul Airport posted on Twitter that it was time to close this phase of the operation now. But we haven't forgotten the people who still need to leave, he said, and we'll continue to do everything we can to help them. Nor have we forgotten the brave, decent people of Afghanistan. They deserve to live in peace and security. Hang on. I lost myself. Yeah, here we go. As the flow of planes leaving Kabul slowed, others arrived in locales around the world carrying Afghans who managed to secure places on the last evacuation flights, including the Washington area, Philadelphia, Madrid, and Birmingham, England. Some passengers were relieved and looked forward to starting new lives far from the Taliban, but others were bitter about having to flee. In Spain, Shabir Ahmadi, a journalist targeted by the Taliban, said the United States had doomed the work of he and others had put into place by making Afghanistan a better place by allowing insurgent groups to reclaim power. They abandoned the new generation of Afghanistan, Ahmadi said. The evacuation flight to Britain landed with extra passengers after the cabin crew delivered a baby girl midair, Turkish media reported. The parents named her Heva or Eve. She was the least of the fourth babies known to have been born to Afghani mothers who were in labor on evacuation flights. Wow. Meanwhile, families of Afghanis killed on Thursday suicide bombing at the airport by the Islamic terror group affiliated continued burying their dead. At least 169 Afghanis and 13 U.S. service members were killed, among them Bella Asfeli. 36, a contractor for the U.S.-funded project who had gone to the airport on his own without his wife. His remains were so disfigured that he could only be identified when someone picked up the family's repeated calls to the cell phone he had with him, relatives said. The U.S. on Saturday released names of the 13 Marines, Navy, and Army personnel who were killed in the bombing. One of the Marines, recently promoted, Sergeant Nicole Gee, 23, was seen in a widely circulated photo cuddling an Afghan infant temporarily rescued from the crush of the crowds outside the airport gates this month. Taliban spokesman Zabhudi Majihad claimed Saturday that the group's forces were holding some positions within the airport and were ready to peacefully take control of it as the American forces flew out. But Pentagon spokesman John Kirby denied the claim. The Taliban did deploy extra forces outside of the airport to prevent large crowds from gathering in the wake of Thursday's bombing. New layers of checkpoints sprang up on roads leading to the airport, some manned by uniformed Taliban fighters with Humvees and night vision goggles captured from Afghani security forces. Areas where the crowds had gathered over the past 2 weeks in hopes of fleeing the country were largely empty. Officials said U.S. forces were taking every precaution at the airport, as there were concerns that IS, which is a far more radical than Taliban, could strike again. A new security alert from U.S. Embassy on Sunday morning said, due to specific credible threat, all U.S. citizens should avoid certain gates at the airport and avoid traveling to that area. In his statement earlier, Biden said a drone strike he ordered that killed what military officials described as two high-profile ISIS militants, believed to have been involved in planning or facilitating the attack, would not be his last response to Thursday's suicide attack. An Afghani who worked as a translator for the U.S. military said he was with a group of people with permission to leave who tried to reach the airport late Friday. After passing through three checkpoints, they were stopped at a fourth. An argument ensued, and the Taliban said they were told by the Americans to let only U.S. passport holders through. "I am so hopeless for my future," the man later told the Associated Press, speaking on the condition of anonymity, I always kill stuff, because of security concerns. "If the evacuation is over, what will happen to us?" Kirby, the Pentagon spokesman, said Saturday that Afghans who had worked with American forces were still being allowed in. According to the State Department spokesman, 5,400 Americans and likely more than, have been safely evacuated from Afghanistan since August 14th. Including nearly 300 Americans in the last day. Another 350 were still seeking to leave the country, and those were only ones that the department could confirm that were still in Afghanistan. Biden said he would adhere to the self-imposed Tuesday deadline for withdrawing all U.S. forces, and the Taliban have rejected any extension. They have encouraged Afghans to stay, pleading amnesty even to those who fought against them, and said that commercial flights would resume after the U.S. withdrawal, but it's unclear if airlines will be willing to offer service. As the deadline neared, with the Taliban controlling nearly all of the country, hundreds of protesters, including many civil servants, gathered outside a bank, while countless more lined up at cash machines. They said they hadn't been paid for 3 to 6 weeks, 3 to 6 months, wow, and were unable to withdraw cash. ATM machines were operating, but withdrawals were limited to about $200 every 24 hours. Later Saturday, the central bank ordered commercial bank branches to open and allow customers to withdraw $200 per week, calling it a temporary measure. The economic crisis, which predates the Taliban takeover, could give Western nations leverage as they urge Afghanistan's new rulers to form a moderate, inclusive government and allow people to leave after Tuesday. Afghanistan is heavily dependent upon international aid, which covered about 75% of the toppled Western-backed government's budget. The Taliban said they want good relations with the international community and have promised a moderate form of Islamic rule than which they last governed the country, but many Afghanis are deeply skeptical. The Taliban cannot access almost any of the central bank's $9 billion in reserves, most of which are held by the New York Federal Reserve. The International Monetary Fund has also suspended transfer of $450 million. Without a regular supply of U.S. dollars, the local currency is at risk of collapse, which could send the prices of basic goods soaring. The U.S. and its allies have said they will continue providing humanitarian aid through the U.N. and other partners, but any broader engagement, including developmental assistance, is likely to hinge on whether the Taliban deliver on their promises of more moderate rule. I don't know if they're obviously a lot of people are skeptical. This is a slain Marine who cradled baby at Kabul Airport. Loved their job. This is a Marine sergeant who cradled it. And this, I guess, went viral. A Marine sergeant who cradled a baby in her arms at the airport and posted on social media that she loved her job. A young husband with his child on the way. A man who planned to become a sheriff's deputy. Okay, more. This is just more details, basically, or details that I've already covered. But apparently, let me see. Okay, yeah, this undated photo, and this is the photo of her holding the infant in her arms. You can't see it, but if you, it's been all over the place. This undated photo provided by U.S. Department of Defense Twitter page posted on August 20 shows Sergeant Nicole Gee holding a baby, Hazmat Karzai, International Airport in Kabul. Didn't that guy used to be president? Anyway, Afghanistan officials said Saturday 28 that that Sergeant Nicole Gee of Sacramento, California, was killed in Tuesday's bombing. So that's just the photo. All right, where am I? This is the Washington Examiner talking about the possibility. Second attack in Kabul highly likely within 24 to 36 hours, Biden says. Joe Biden warned the situation in Kabul, Afghanistan remains extremely dangerous amid threat of terrorism. You have to, and maybe I'll start to provide a little bit of commentary here. We have to assume that there are, within the Taliban itself, there are probably more moderate elements, and there are probably more radicalized elements. You don't have a moderate party, in cahoots with other more radical groups in regards to that bombing. I mean, they talk. I mean, there's talk between, there's chatter and whatnot between these groups. I don't think anything goes on without the other group to one degree or another at least being aware of it. So they're definitely not to be trusted. And so there are obviously right out the gate more radical elements that are looking to destabilize and cause as much damage as possible, because obviously they cause more damage to their own people trying to leave than they did to the U.S. forces. What was it? 197 was, is that what that number was? I think it was up as high as that. So when you have various, I mean, I don't think the Taliban can follow through on what it's saying, even if it wanted to, is what it comes down to. So, and it'd be kind of interesting if there winds up being more of a, I don't know if you could call it a civil war, more of an uncivil war. It's the whole place is just going to be totally, totally destabilized. It's just going to be crazy. You know, and again, if the Taliban is willing to go moderate, then that's not going to, that's not going to sit well with various other more radical groups. So you might have, you might have more attacks just to try and destabilize. What a shit show, not for nothing. Biden said he directed field commanders to take every possible measure to prioritize force protection in the event of a second attack following Thursday's explosion that killed 13 U.S. service members and injured another 18. They assured me that they did and that they could take these measures while completing the mission and safely retrograding our personnel, he said in a statement. I'm not quite sure what that means. Biden's warning was given after the Pentagon spokesman John Kirby cautioned that the threat of terrorism remains active and dynamic. And yeah, and I guess that's really a more succinct way of putting it. I believe there's going to be acts of terrorism, even if the Taliban itself decides that it needs to be more moderate in order to play nice internationally and get the aid and the funds released. I don't think that's going to bode well with the radicals who will engage in acts of terrorism in regards to inflicting as much damage as they can, because they don't want the Western influence. So that being said, U.S. responded to attack against ISIS-K targets. I still don't know what ISIS-K is in particular. I've been reading through stuff. I hear it, referenced, but I don't know where they came from. I'm sure someone out there knows where they came from. Have I got any Afghanistan stuff left? This is the UK evacuating. This is out of Sky News. Yeah, I'm going to pass on that. And I just read that one. I did have a level of repetition in here to some degree. But yeah, this is out of ProjectPatriot.com. Biden administration, thousands of ISIS-K prisoners have been released by the Taliban. The Biden administration not only negotiates with terrorists, but it currently is working with the terror group, which reportedly claimed responsibility for the suicide bombings that left 13 U.S. service members dead in Kabul on Thursday. That sounds like hyperbole, but it's most certainly not. At least not according to Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. Kirby on Friday was answering questions about the deadly Kabul attack against our troops, which was believed to have been carried out by a group called ISIS-K, or the Islamic State Khorasan province, when he let that slip. Per Kirby, thousands of these terrorists were released from a prison located near Bagram Air Force Base, which the U.S. abandoned earlier this month. Ugh. President Joe Biden's Pentagon didn't bother to remove these. President Joe Biden's Pentagon didn't bother to remove these cretins when he bunged the Afghan pullout, so that when Bagram was overrun by the Taliban, our apparent security partners in Kabul, the militant group let them go. So they liberated. Apparently, they live. We gave up the Air Force Base, which we shouldn't have done. And apparently, there were prisoners being held, and they were liberated by the Taliban. How many were released? Thousands of them, it says. How many ISIS-K prisoners were left at Bagram and believed to have been released from the prison there, and why weren't they removed before the U.S. pulled out to someplace like Gitmo? Kirby was asked by a Fox News reporter, Jennifer Griffin. Well, I don't know the exact number. Clearly, it's in the thousands, said Kirby, who didn't answer why these people were left to the Taliban. Griffin also asked how the Defense Department can be certain that the Taliban did not assist in Thursday's bombing. Kirby dodged the question, of course. On August 15th, the Taliban captured Bagram and opened up its prison access, reported at the time. The outlet noted it was believed those prisoners posed a threat to the U.S., which is probably why they were prisoners. On a phone call between top Biden officials and senators from both parties, Senator Lindsey Graham asked Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and General Mark Milley, whether in light of the recent events they would advise assessments to Congress in June of a medium risk of terrorist groups reconstituting in Afghanistan within 2 years, Axios reported. I think it is Milley. Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, reported in the affirmative. But the general, obsessed with Marxism and white rage, apparently did nothing about a perceived terror threat. The Bagram prison reportedly held ISIS-K affiliates that the U.S. had in custody and knew to be dangerous. Then ISIS-K on Thursday permanently altered 13 American families after being left behind during Biden's hasty retreat. The Biden administration has blood on its hands, and so does the Pentagon. The critical race theory saturated military left behind people in a prison that posed an immediate threat to America in Afghanistan. Fewer than 2 weeks after they were released by monsters who in the White House... Fewer than 2 weeks after they were released by monsters who the White House is working with, Americans died. We don't know if the Taliban worked with ISIS-K cells to kill troops or if the terror group simply set them free, allowing them to set the attack in motion. So, yeah, what would the difference be? What would the difference be there? You know, if you stop and think about this for a moment, right? So you have these radicalized prisoners who were locked up, these terrorists who were locked up, and we abandoned the base and the prison, meaning U.S. U.S. forces, and the Taliban came in and took over the base and liberated, apparently liberated these terrorists, and these terrorists engaged in an act of terror that killed 13 Americans less than 2 weeks later, by the way. What would the difference be if the Taliban actively participated in the attack or not? Because they certainly set free those who did actively participate in the attack. So to me, there's no difference there. No difference at all. And it also speaks of the idea of the Taliban not being able to control radical elements, which I alluded to earlier. So anyway, the administration could have come up with a plan for ending an unpopular war and then executed it. Miley and Austin could have adapted to the conditions on the ground when it was apparent that leaving Afghanistan was one giant mess, and neither man did. Everyone else had saved innocent lives. Everyone else could have saved innocent lives, but chose not to. Our leaders spent the summer celebrating diversity while our enemies plotted. Thursday, those enemies struck. No matter which way you look at it, the Biden administration facilitated what happened in the airport in Kabul on Thursday. Yeah, that goes without saying. Suddenly, it all makes sense why the flag-draped coffins had to be flown home. The Biden administration negotiates with Taliban terrorists, and to make it worse, it does so from a place of little leverage. If Biden, Austin, or Miley had any integrity, each man would resign immediately for the carnage they've caused in Afghanistan, excuse me. Americans are dead right now for no reason other than because leaders were arrogant and incompetent. And this was in the Western Journal, originally appeared in the Western Journal, and this was Kip Jones. So I guess it's, I guess we'd call it the opinion piece. I kind of staggered through that. I find myself, let me see. All right, and, all right, well, let's do this. This is Yahoo News. What a fucking mess. Can I get in here? Is this, I guess. Okay, yeah, okay. Future Kabul airport subject of intense negotiations. Who ultimately run Kabul after U.S. forces leave? That question, a vital one for Afghanistan's new Taliban rulers, but also for Western nations still hoping to evacuate everyone eligible. It is the subject of intense and complex talks. Next week, on September 1st, Hamid Karzai Airport, he was. That was the heroin-addicted guy that we set up. I don't think that was the first dude, if I recall correctly. Boy, it's been so long. Will be under control of hardline Islamists. So they're saying September 1st, who already on Friday claimed to have moved into certain areas of the military side of the facility. We're departing August 31st. Upon that date, we are essentially giving the airport back to the Afghan people, State Department spokesperson Ned Price said Friday, cutting off speculation about the possibility of it falling into international hands. However, the Afghan government collapsed. The Afghan government collapsed in the face of the Taliban advance on Kabul, and now the one-time insurgents are in power, but still haven't even formed a government. Okay, pause for a moment. Pause. That's basically there seems to be a recurring thread through this. I guess that's most clearly stated thus far. There is no government in Afghanistan right now. Everybody's a terrorist. I'm trying to like figure out in my head how to delineate between these various factions. And at the end of the day, they're all fucking terrorists. We basically, this is that, you know, that infamous vacuum, you know, that gets talked about from time to time, you know, like the one that we left behind when we left Iraq. We're doing it again because apparently we're not very good at nation building, you know, as if that wasn't, you know, we get a clue, you know, like there's been no examples of that recently falling apart. I refuse, and this is double negative, I refuse to believe that there wasn't a better way to execute this. I refuse to believe that there wasn't a better way of executing it. It probably would have fallen apart anyway. as these things are wont to do. I guess we could have talked to the Russians about that, or I think the English were in there for a little while in Afghanistan. I think everybody's been through fucking Afghanistan, and nobody's come out any better for it. Nobody's come out any better for it. All right, let me pick up on this. Let's see. Running an airport is a uncomplicated piece of business, Price said. I think it is probably unreasonable to expect that there would be normal airport operations on September 1st. Oh, you think? The idea that the airport could temporarily close was raised on Wednesday by his boss, Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He said that there have been very active efforts by countries in the region to see whether they could help keep it open or, as necessary, reopen it if it closes for some period of time. Blinken insisted that the fate of the airport was important to the Taliban, who did not want to find themselves once again heading a pariah regime, as they did from 96 to 2001. The Islamists are especially hoping to see humanitarian aid quickly flow into the country. But the airport is also important for Western countries who want to be able to get their citizens out of Afghanistan, as well as thousands of Afghani allies who cannot be evacuated in the U.S.-led airlift before August 31. That is going to get ugly. You know, the idea of, even though the Taliban is claiming there won't be any retaliations against anybody who allied with the U.S. forces or, I guess even NATO forces, they're claiming there will be no repercussions, but apparently, they're not in total control of the situation. So I don't understand how they can be making promises or guarantees of what amounts to amnesty to Afghani citizens. It's the whole thing is just a mess. There's going to be a lot of dead Afghanis by the time this is over. Up until now, NATO has played a key role. The alliance's civil personnel have taken care of air traffic control, fuel supplies, and communications, while military contingents from Turkey, the U.S., Britain, and Azerbaijan, God help me, were in charge of security. With the withdrawal of international forces rapidly approaching, it is Wonkman thought that perhaps Turkey could step into the breach. Yeah, I don't know if we want that happening. Maintaining responsibility for securing the perimeter of the airport. Well, maybe, yeah. Oh my God. The hope was that the Taliban would accept the presence of a small force from Turkey, a mainly Muslim nation that is also part of NATO. But once they took power, the Taliban have repeatedly said they will not accept any foreign military presence in Afghanistan after August 31st, and the Turkish soldiers have begun to pull out. However, negotiations have continued on the diplomatic front. After the first talks on Friday between Turkish officials and the Taliban in Kabul, Turkish President, I can't even pronounce it, Erdogan, I used to be able to say that dude's name, revealed that the Taliban now want to oversee security at the airport while offering Turkey the option of running its logistics. Okay, well, that's moving in a certain direction. We'll make a decision once the calm prevails. Beyond Turkey, the discussions of the future of the airport have included Qatar and private operators, while the United States has said it is acting as a facilitator. But the question of who takes over the airport is a sensitive one. Beyond security concerns, the airport is in a bad state, U.S. officials said, adding that apart from the U.S. Army, there have been a few entities in the world capable of taking charge of it from one day to the next. U.S. and Western experts on air traffic had just completed an evaluation of the airport in a bid to assess its commercial flights could resume quickly, Price said Friday. Other officials are more blunt, said there won't be many airlines that will agree to fly to Kabul as long as the Taliban are unable to offer real assurances on security and that infrastructure is in a good working order. Well, again, I think that was proven on Thursday, that the Taliban obviously is not totally in control of the situation and not able to provide security. I mean, I don't, you know, it's,
I don't get it.
I mean, what are we doing? Are we just hoping for the best? We're just taking what they say because they're saying the right things, or what we perceive to be the right things at that particular moment? Is that what's happening?
You can't believe a word these fuckers say. You can't believe a fucking word. They're not in control of the situation. I have 13 American lives to point to and 197 Afghani lives to point to say that the Taliban is not calling the shots entirely. Not. That being said. Whew. It just doesn't end. All right, let's see. This is August 16th. Yeah, this is a little old. I'm not going to read that one. This is actually related to, I got to break out of this. Okay, this will be the last thing on Afghanistan that I'll do. This was out of USA Today. It's called 13 Beers, an Empty Table. It's very sensitive. Very sensitive. Okay, here it is. 13 Beers, an Empty Table, a quiet but powerful way restaurants are honoring those who were killed in Kabul. Restaurants and businesses across the country are choosing to reserve a table and 13 beers to honor the service members who died during Thursday's bombing near Kabul Hamid Karzai Airport, International Airport. Ironwood Cafe in Ohio said the news hit close to home. Maxton Max Sovic was a native of Milan, Ohio, and was among the fallen. My husband, grandfather, and many in my family served, so when I read that one of Ohio's own died, I knew I wanted to make a small gesture to honor Max and the 12 other soldiers, Shannon Vasquez, general manager of the cafe, told the USA Today. Vasquez said one of her regular customers saw the 13 beers, gave her a big hug, and said, "This reminds me of my grandpa who died in the line of duty." Also in Ohio, Nico Muganis said he felt compelled to do something too. He called his bar's general manager and told her about reserving an entire table for 13 beers to honor the service members. She told me, "You do realize it's Friday night, right?" I said, "Yeah, but you do realize these people are not coming back to their families." Mulaganas, Greek guy, owner of Nico's Bar in Yeros, told USA Today. He didn't stop there. Until September 11th, he will donate $1 for every beer they sell. Proceeds will go to military charities or specifically to families of the 13 who died. On top of beer sales, they said they've received cash donations from local customers and hope veterans afflicted and military families see the 13 beers and feel supported and seen. A father came up to me with tears in his eyes. "My son is a Marine, so I thank you. I told him there's no reason to thank me. I thank you and your son." Michael Moriana, co-owner of First Line Brewery in New York, has also been displaying 13 beers inside the brewery. Staff refreshed the pints throughout the night so the beers remain cold, Moriana said, and a portion of the proceeds from this weekend will be donated to military-run charities for fallen service members. Customers have donated about $2,000 in cash since Friday, he said. Other local businesses and bars in the area have followed the brewery lead. One flower shop placed 13 roses outside their shop. "It was a great way to see our community showing up. It's great to see our community showing up to support soldiers and their afflicted families. We want them to know that at least we are here for them in any small or big way they need." A barbershop in Delaware decided to reserve a single Tiana shop and set out 13 beers as well. The owner of Amstel Barbershop, Robert Allen, placed a folded U.S. flag on top of the chair in hopes of customers take a few minutes to honor the lost soldiers. Allen said almost everybody in the city of Middletown knows a veteran or someone currently serving and are heartbroken by the Kabul attack. On a busy Saturday, Allen said he wanted people to stop and remember the two sacrifices and heroes. Somebody lost a piece of their family they'll never get back. putting 13 beers to honor the lives of those soldiers is at least any American can do right now, Alan told USA Today. Hannah Nielsen, a kitchen manager at AJ O'Brady's restaurant in Wisconsin, heard from a former employee who left to become a Marine that some of the men in her unit died in the Kabul attack. Nielsen told restaurant owner Bruce Russell they had to do something. Nielsen saw other businesses in the bar setting out 13 beers for the fallen soldiers, so AJ O'Brady's staff did the same, except his customers went one step further. Since Friday, dozens have offered to pay for the beer or the meal of any veteran or military family who comes into the restaurant. We want to make sure everyone in our restaurant felt this loss and honor the soldiers. We're active in the community, and we want to shed light on what's happening, Nielsen told USA Today. Russell said the community reaction has been overwhelming. Customers have seen the 13 beers and asked why and how they can help military families. Some have offered donations, while others have thanked and hugged local veterans. These families, the sacrifices, and those soldiers who died deserve to be seen. So in our small way, we put our 13 beers to honor them, which isn't half of what they deserve, but it's something, Russell told USA Today. I can't do any more Afghanistan. I got like two or three that are left that are not Afghanistan related. I just need to get myself together. Whew. This is where, like I said, dumping out into something, some sort of music or something probably would have been helpful from a production standpoint, but I just didn't have the heart to be able to do that. 9/11 is fast approaching the 20th anniversary, and this is out of pjmedia.com, and this would be outrageous Virginia public schools to focus on Muslims as victims in teaching about 9/11 on the attack's 20th anniversary. And this is Robert Spencer, August 28th. On Thursday, the Virginia Department of Education published a video entitled Culturally Responsive and Inclusive 9/11 Commemoration, detailing how Virginia public school teachers should handle the upcoming 20th anniversary of 9/11 jihad attacks that killed nearly 3,000 Americans. The emphasis on that day and hereafter must not be seen as ideology of the attackers or the ongoing jihad terror threat. Rather, the focus is entirely on acknowledging and eradicating what the video calls anti-Muslim racism. The video, narrated by a hijab-wearing woman, Amma Dakura, who describes herself as a professional lecturer, School of Education, American University, and Paragon Education Counseling President. One would think that with all her expertise, Ms. DeCure, DeCuri, would know the elementary fact that Islam is not a race. That's really good. And that Muslims and Islamic jihadists of all races. Okay, let me repeat that. One would think with all her expertise that Ms. DeCure would know the elementary fact that Islam is not a race and that there are Muslims and Islamic jihadists of all races. And of course, she does know that, but she's operating in this video on the basis of leftist contention that opposition to jihad violence and Sharia oppression of women really stems from the irrational animus against Muslims as a people, and hence a racialized form of hate. Yes, it's toxic nonsense, but that's the left for you. In any case, the Virginia public schools have implemented Mr. Kerr's recommendations, and since the Virginia Department of Education published a video, it would appear that the department wants that to be all of them. We'll give students a presentation on the 20th anniversary of the worst attack ever on American soil that will portray Muslims as the primary victims of those attacks and make Herculean efforts to deflect attention away from the extremely inconvenient fact that the attacks were perpetrated in the name of Islam and in accordance with its teachings. If you could doubt that fact, or if you doubt that fact, then note in March 2009, five masterminds of the 9/11 plot, Qaeda Sheikh Mohammed, Ramiz bin Az Shabiz, Walden bin Attash, Mustafa Ahmed al-Hawazi, and Ali bin Aziz Ali, styling themselves as 9/11 Shura Council, wrote a lengthy communique titled "The Islamic Response to the Government's Nine Accusations." In it, they call the 9/11 attacks an act of jihad and explain that jihad in God's cause is a great duty in our religion. They quoted numerous Quran verses, including notorious verse of the sword, "Then fight and slay pagans wherever you find them, and seize them, and besiege them, lie in wait for them in each and every ambush," and another enjoining Muslims to strike terror into the heart of the enemies of Allah. Attorney and columnist Marina Medvin, who broke the story of this video, notes that the 9/11 Commission report mentions Islam over 1,000 times and the word Muslim over 1,000 times for obvious reasons. But Virginia students will learn nothing of any of that. Instead, they will be taught about phobias stemming from 9/11, anti-Muslim racism spikes, and the evils of the fictional Muslim ban. Dakir offers an example of harmful teaching. Any teaching about Islam and or Muslims in connection with 9/11, except evidently insofar as Muslims were victims of the American response to the attacks. All of this is designed to help keep teachers, all of this is designed to help teachers disrupt anti-Muslim racism by implementing existing district anti-bullying policies. The video offers three examples of Muslim students who have claimed to have faced this bullying. One says, 9/11 every single year is so awkward. The administration would be like, on this fateful day, this happened, and then Muslim jokes would come up. Like, don't blow us up, don't do this. When I was younger, it bothered me, but now I'm desensitized to it. Well, that's a shame. Certainly schools should do what they can to avoid bullying of all kinds. They should also remember a truth has been lost. Children are often cruel to one another on whatever pretext they can find. And if that's based on one thing, if it's not based on one thing, it'll be another. No Muslim students should be bullied. Making all teaching on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 about Muslims being victimized, not just personally, but also politically by counterterrorism measures in the U.S., however, is spectacularly wrong-headed. Okay. Students should be taught that no one is guilty of any criminal or terrorist act except those who plotted and perpetrated it. At the same time, students should be taught about the ideological wellsprings of the 9/11 attacks, just as they should be taught about the ideological wellsprings of Pearl Harbor and the Nazi invasion of Poland, so as to work towards ensuring that such acts of violence and hatred are never repeated. Ding, 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 ding. To pretend that 9/11 didn't spring from beliefs and assumptions that can be found in Islamic teachings is simply to deny reality. And denying reality never ends well. This doesn't remotely mean that all Muslims are terrorists or that all innocent Muslims should be victimized. But leftists frequently claim that enunciating truths that don't wish to acknowledge will result in victimization of innocent people. They never seem to notice this possibility when it comes to their own poisonous race baiting and classist rhetoric. Interesting. On September 11, 2001, the United States of America was attacked by Islamic jihadists acting in the name of Islam and in the service of its 1,400-year cause. To claim anything else is an outrage to the truth, history, and those who have given their lives to defend our beleaguered republic since then
including the 13 service members killed in Kabul on the same day as the Virginia Department of Education posted this video. Well, I'm done. I can't do anymore. I'm emotionally drained. Literally, I didn't think, you know, I knew what I was going to be doing going in. You know, that's why, again, I decided I couldn't find anything from a musical standpoint that would, you know, do any of this justice. And I knew that this was going to be difficult to do. I don't think I had anticipated it being this difficult. I'm emotionally drained. I'm just like shot. I'm just going to go and cry into a pillow. It's basically what I'm going to do. I'm really, this is not good. But I think it was important. This is, I guess, my equivalent of 13 beers, I guess. I don't even know if I have 13 listeners, but I have 13 beers. that being said, I'm going to get out of here. I'm leaving. Head over to lfmidwood.com. You got my archives out there. You got my social media. You got, my favorites, which is where I call some, if not all, of this news from. If you head up to the top of the page, you'll see 11LRNI on the links there. That'll take you over to John Lightning site. Plenty of archives over there of John, of Dave the Boogeyman, of Big Steve Cole. All the way over to the right, our good friend Brad Reed over there at Grits Radio. And that's it. I'm out. I'm going to play just a short out, and then I'm leaving. So I'll be back next week. You know, I didn't, and again, I don't know, I didn't feel well. I really honestly, I didn't say anything when I started the show because I didn't want to say anything. But I really honestly didn't feel well. I felt really bad physically. And I thought it was important to come on, so I came on. I feel pretty shitty right now, and I feel worse, quite frankly. But that being said, I hope to be back next week. So check, you know, there may be occasion for me not being back, if my illness, it affects me that deeply, and that severely, which it almost did, but we managed to make it through. I got my ass into the chair and I turned the microphone thingy on and I turned it on and it worked. So, that being said, you know, thanks for imbibing. Like I said, I know there's so much media out there, especially this week, that you didn't have to. You know, there's plenty of other places to turn to, you know, other than me. But I appreciate the fact that you do. And I'll see you on the other side.
You've been listening to the Midwood Files on Radio New York International. Thanks for listening.